Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition, available April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to a TVO podcast.
The following podcast contains coarse language, descriptions of violence, and sensitive themes which may not be suitable for younger audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
I'm Colin Ellis, and you're listening to On Docs, a podcast about documentaries and the stories they tell. I'm excited to announce that joining me on the podcast as my new co-host is the one and only Nam Kiwanuka. Hello, Nam.
So, okay, when I'm from East Africa, and when you're excited about something, that's what you do. Thank you, Colin. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Thanks for being our new co-host. I'm really excited to have you with us. You were on our previous episode on James Baldwin and another episode we did on the 13th Amendment back in the summer of 2020, which feels like ages ago.
And the longest year ever, yeah.
I know, right? But there's a lot more to you than that. So why don't you just tell our audience just a little bit about you?
Well, I'm a host producer on The Agenda with Steve Bacon, and I host The Agenda in the summer. But I think a lot of people recognize me from my bountiful hair from way back when I was on Much Music as a VJ. And I've also covered the NBA way back when it was hockey country. We were doing the basketball show, myself and Cabby, on NBA XL.
We've known each other for a long time, going back, I guess, 5 years?
Yeah, you were my first producer at TVO, and you made me
feel very welcomed,
yeah.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, I hope you feel welcome here on our podcast, and thank you again for joining us. So you're going to be joining me from time to time just to talk about the latest documentaries, including the one we're talking about today. What are we talking about?
Well, I love documentaries on music because music background, but today we're going to be talking about the new Netflix documentary. It's called Biggie, I Got a Story to Tell, and it's executive produced by Biggie's mom, Valletta Wallace, and Sean Combs. I think it's Sean Combs today because he was also Diddy, Puffy, but I don't know. I'm just going to go with Sean Combs, and unlike other documentaries about Big, this documentary focuses more on how he lived and became the notorious B.I.G. and rather than how he died. I would consider it an origin story. I know you love comic books, right? And every superhero has an origin story.
Yes, and Biggie was definitely a superhero.
Oh, for sure, for sure. And so this documentary, yeah, it gives us a unique look into who B.I.G. was when he wasn't on stage performing. We learn about the person who introduced him to drug dealing, his family in Jamaica who played a pivotal role in his musical journey, and a childhood mentor who introduced him to jazz. Here's a listen.
That's all it was a dream.
Something special was about to happen. My boy get 3 years, he get nervous.
Yeah, I can't be, you know, looking like, you know, 21. Sure. I'm gonna keep that 18.
You know what I mean? That 18 feel, those liberties.
My son was a very smart kid.
He was already writing since elementary.
I was initially trying to groom Chris to be a jazz artist because he was so talented.
Every summer, Chris would come back from Jamaica. He would be a sponge to just so much more that was outside of our scope.
He was like, I gotta get us off the streets.
Both of us are obviously big hip-hop fans, but we wanted to have on a hip-hop super fan and an actual rapper to come on and talk about this with us. So who do we have?
We've got Shad. He's a Canadian hip-hop artist, and he's the host of Hip Hop Evolution on Netflix. Plus, he's a Juno Award winner, so I think he knows his music.
And he's got a little bit of a connection to you, doesn't he?
Yes. So Shad and I, we call each other cousins, but we're not cousins. Like, we're not blood cousins. He's from Rwanda. I'm from Uganda and Kenya. But we grew up together in London, Ontario. And I used to babysit Shad. So, you know, when people pull up those photos of someone in like a diaper, I might have a few of those. But I would never do that to Shad because Shad's a great guy.
Yes, no, please. He was a great person to talk to, and obviously knows his stuff. And I wish I had a rapper cousin. Jeez.
Well, by extension, now you do. Now, because
we're cousins. Yes, all right, yes. Well, I'm really excited to have you join me for this episode and future episodes we do. So let's just get into it. This is me, Nam, and Shad talking about Biggie. I got a story to tell. Well, Shad, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast.
My pleasure.
I have to ask you because, you know, you're obviously a well-respected rapper, and I'm sure you were a big Notorious B.I.G. fan, or maybe you weren't. I don't know. What was your, I guess, introduction to him growing up?
Yeah, I was a huge fan. I mean, we all were at that time, right? I think when his first album came out, I was maybe 12 or 13. So I was in that phase of like being into every single thing that came out. But of course, he stood out, and Juicy stood out for me at that age. And then when this double album dropped, I mean, it was everything posthumously. But yeah, I think I'm in an age demographic where I was touched by Kurt Cobain and Biggie and Tupac, but I was on the younger side. Like, I didn't really know what they represented for the culture quite, you know, really until later.
I think I'm the same. I think I'm about the same age as you. And I was about, 13, probably when Ready to Die came out. And it took me a while to kind of catch up to him. But I obviously knew his music, and I knew, like, I saw the videos on Much Music all the time, and remember very well when he was killed. But I think it was sort of a, for me at least, appreciating his music was, it took a while because I was, I guess, still a little too young. Nam, what about you?
For me, it wasn't the double album so much from Biggie. For me, it was the first one, Ready to Die, because I'm a bit older than you guys. I mean, a year or two only. so for me, it was Ready to Die. And at the time, I was writing for Mike Check magazine, which was an urban zine back in the day in the 90s. And I was working, I was trying to get into the music industry. I think we had just gone to, there used to be this conference called How Can I Be Down in Miami. And that was like the place where everybody, it was like a street marketing festival. This is before social media. So this is like everybody who's in music and hip hop music would descend on that city, Master P, the Hot Boys. I mean, it was, when I went that one year, it was just incredible. So for me, when Big died and when Tupac died, it was, I was a super fan, but I was also getting into the industry and kind of seeing the business side of it and how complicated that was and how ugly that could be. And I remember getting phone calls from my friends because they were, one of my friends was in LA when Tupac died. And then he was also in LA when Big died. And both times he sent me a page saying, this just happened.
Rapper Biggie Smalls was shot to death in Los Angeles early this morning while leaving a party. His death comes almost exactly 6 months to the day that another rapper, Tupac Shakur, was fatally shot in Las Vegas.
Every time we had a conversation about what just happened, it just felt like the world was moving underneath your feet. And I know we're going to talk about the documentary, but watching the documentary kind of took me back to that time. And I realized that after Big died, a shift happened in me as a fan. And I think that was when I kind of stepped away from the music. And then it just became kind of business for me. And maybe, Shad, you don't want to hear that because, you know, you're a maker, you're a creator of the music. But I think because I had been a fan for such a long time, and then I saw the business side of it, and it just felt like it was such a waste for these two super talented human beings who are loved by so many people to die under those circumstances. For me, it was just kind of like, it just made me reevaluate my relationship with music in that at that time.
Yeah, that's so interesting to hear because, again, I was too young to understand really what it all meant to the culture, right? But working on Hip Hop Evolution, and we have obviously an episode where we talk about those two deaths, and to see it all in context and how hip hop changed and did become more like business oriented, like just in general, you know what I mean? Like it really was the start of like, well, Master P came in a little bit after that. And obviously Diddy continued to like, you know, be successful. Jay-Z was in his phase of like, I'm really looking at this like a business. So I think it changed a lot of people, Nam. Like, I think it changed the whole thing. Like, we'll get into it all.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I guess for anyone who's not familiar with Biggie's music, or Biggie himself, I should just say, you know, he was born and raised in Brooklyn, New York, and Bedford-Stuyvesant, which I think you can give him credit for kind of making famous, right? You know, he came from a single mother who was from Jamaica. And actually, this film, I think more than any other doc I've seen about him, really explored his Jamaican roots and just how it played into his rap style. What did you guys think of that?
For Hip Hop Evolution, actually, we filmed a whole week in Jamaica. We didn't use it.
Really? How come? Why not?
Because, you know, ultimately you have to pick a starting point, right, for the story of hip hop. You could go back. You could keep going back and keep going back and keep going back. But, you know, we filmed there because Jamaica is so important to the story of hip hop. You can hear it in his style, you know, and so many other, like, great rappers and DJs. Like Jamaican music culture is in the DNA of hip hop heavy. So that was very cool to see that in the doc, because it's kind of like undertold, the story of that.
I didn't know
that relationship. Yeah,
I like this documentary because it was about how he lived and not about how he died. Because I think all the other documentaries that I've seen about Big, it's been about that feud, and it kind of erased him as an individual. So seeing this documentary where he's with his mother, showing the connection with his mother, we knew about that, but also the connection that he had with his uncle. Going back to Jamaica every summer, his mom made sure that he would go back, and so he knew that side of himself. And then when he came back, his friends in the documentary were saying, you know, he would bring records from Jamaica, and he would incorporate, because he had Jamaican slang in his songs. And I was always like, you know, some of my friends would have debates like, well, you know, I think when you come from Toronto, you just kind of co-opt, you know, the Jamaican. I don't think it's not right, but it's so ingrained in Toronto culture, music culture, right? And we would be like, okay. But I think that's what that was one part of his appeal, because people here would hear it. We're in Toronto, but at the time when they had that East-West thing, we're in the East Coast, so obviously Big is our guy. And then when you'd hear that Jamaican slang in the songs, you're like, see, I told you. I mean, he's our guy. You know, you're not going to hear Tupac using that that slang. But I also felt really sad because his uncle that was in the documentary that obviously influenced him with music, his uncle is still alive. His granny in Jamaica is still alive, and his granny is in her 90s. And to see these people from his life that were part of his childhood and part of his sound, part of who he was as a musician, as an artist, still alive, but he's not here. It also made me very sad to see.
I also like the, you know, the influence of jazz on his style as well. There was a jazz musician, a saxophonist named Donald Harrison, who kind of mentored Biggie and you know, actually wanted him to become a jazz artist. I didn't actually hear that influence in his raps before watching this doc. I don't know if either of you picked up on that.
I wasn't sure what to make of that comment. The jazz, like, I don't suspect that Biggie was writing those rhymes being like, how can I incorporate this jazz rhythm? I don't think that's what happened.
Yeah, I agree.
But they overlaid his rap over a drum beat, right? Mm-hmm. Or like a jazz drum. I'm not familiar with all the musical terms, but I just thought that was kind of an interesting.
Well, his flow is very unorthodox. You know, there's been YouTube videos that kind of break down the way he, how can I put it? It's like most people, they always rhyme at the end of the count, the end of the measure, the end of the bar, or whatever. You can kind of predict when that rhyme is going to fall and when the rhyme is going to change. And with Big, you could never do that. He had a very unorthodox style, but it just was so infectious to, like, listen to and rap along with. So there were definitely some very cool things he did with rhythm. I thought that was maybe a stretch. Like, I don't think he was kind of going, well, yeah, that Buddy Rich thing, let me do that. Like, I don't think he was doing that. But yeah, I think it was cool to talk about the different musical influences, the Jamaican influence. I think, and we'll probably get into this, but just where he was at in Brooklyn, like, you know, there were jazz musicians there. Like, it was an area that's full of culture, right? And I've heard people talk about this when they compare Biggie and Nas, because Nas was in the Queensbridge housing projects, and that was a lot less of a, like, you know, it was a very insular community compared to where Big was at in Brooklyn, where lots of people moving around and going
and arts and culture,
yeah, and lots of arts and culture and stuff. And I've heard people say that's why Big kind of like broke internationally, and Nas with those first couple albums, even though they're classics, they didn't reach that level because his worldview, his experience of the world was just like not the same as Biggs. His world was like insular. So yeah, I think there's something to all the different influences he absorbed and just being in a neighborhood that was rich in music and culture for sure. But I did think that moment was, I did laugh at that. At that moment.
I'd rather make a buck, drive a fat ass truck, grab the 9-2 clips and run amok. Yes, flex after 2 or 3 bexes, I wreck shit. What the fuck you expected? A fly guy? Well, fuck it, I'm a high guy. From bed, stop putting the swelling on your eye. Your nose even, when I choke me, you stop breathing. But police come, I'm bleeding. Peace and love. Here we go.
Well, I thought it was interesting because, again, when you do, in the past, when you hear about Big, it's him and his mom, right? And so hearing his mentor, Donald Harrison, and he, when he was talking, I think for me, the things that I picked up was him taking him to museums and trying to mentor him because he didn't grow up with his father. And there's a lot of things in the documentary that I found out about Big that I didn't know. And for sure, Chad, I think that maybe he was influenced by the jazz music. You know, I think there's, it's hard to separate because we're from East Africa. So obviously those rhythms are influenced in your music too, Chad, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
So the stuff that you grow up with, you it influences your styles. Even if we can't hear it, maybe for a jazz musician, I don't know.
Yeah.
I have a very bad ear. But I thought that it was cool that he had a mentor growing up. And he had this man who had his back and took him to museums and, again, exposed him to more than just the street corner. But I thought it was interesting when Biggie said that he didn't like hip hop, that he liked slow jams. And when he said it, I was like, oh,
I laughed at that. Yeah.
That makes sense. Yeah. But yeah. That makes sense. I'm like, okay, yeah. He had a lot of his music. I think one of the reasons that it was so popular, women liked it. A lot of women liked his music. And then he had, when he started working with Puffy, they would have like the samples, the music, like the Diana Ross sample, where people, it gets people on the dance floor, right? People are kind of familiar with it. You want to dance. And then if you listen to the lyrics, the guys are like, okay, you know, so he had a little bit of, he had a little bit of something for everybody. And the other thing about the doc that I didn't realize that he was shy, because on stage, he has such a presence. And maybe that's the other thing, too, with Nas and Biggie. I mean, Nas is very nice to look at. And Big, you know, in the documentary. Listen, it seems as if he was also self-conscious about how he looked, you know. One of his friends was made a comment about Big, knew that he was big in stature, and he was self-conscious with his lazy eye. That's why he wore the dark glasses. But you wouldn't know that he was self-conscious, and you wouldn't know that he was shy, because when he was on stage, all eyes were on Big. He had this persona that everybody was drawn to him. And, you know, I remember being at a club once back in the day, DJ starting from scratch, used to DJ at this place called Jericho. It would be everywhere, but it was like Jericho was the brand. And I remember listening, he was playing I Love It When You Call Me Big Papa, and the whole place, it was packed, and it was a white party, so everybody was wearing white. And all of a sudden you hear gunshots, and then the club stops, and that is one memory that is seared in my head. But it kind of just takes me back to that time when I'm like, you know, in my early 20s, you're starting to figure out who you are as an adult. And I loved that part of the documentary. I know I just went off on a tangent, but all these little things about him being shy. And then if you see him on stage, you would never know that that's how he felt off stage.
Yeah, I loved all that too. Yeah, as much as I laughed at that little jazz moment, like that mentorship was maybe the most poignant thing in the whole doc to me. You know, just that time in a young person's life where you're just really trying to give them experiences and keep them occupied, and the way this man went out of his way to do that for Big was really poignant to watch. And then, yeah, like the shyness thing was just another reminder to me of how young he was. You know, he didn't have time to get confident, you know, in his own skin. I mean, he had his musical persona, but yeah, like he was too young to get that kind of confidence.
One thing that I think the doc, you know, isn't shy about exploring is his involvement in selling drugs and selling crack specifically. And, you know, even though he had, you know, some positive role models in his life, this jazz musician, his own mother, and he wasn't, you know, he was kind of in an odd area of, I guess, Brooklyn, because he was sort of on the border of, I think it was called the Clinton Hill District, where there was all this cultural influence. And I think he, you know, was between that and I think Bedford Stuyvesant, which was a little rougher. He still was kind of like, I guess, maybe not torn, but, you know, he sort of felt himself pulled in the direction of the drug trade. And I think, you know, even when he was signed, I think he was still selling drugs, and, you know, he wasn't quite successful yet, but he was still kind of, you know, doing that. And then ultimately, I guess he, once Puffy was able to convince him, hey, this is what we need you to, you know, focus on the music, that's when he finally dropped it. But I just thought it was kind of interesting that he still went down that route despite having, I guess, the other options, I guess.
Well, we see it in retrospect, and we're like, come on, Big, what are you doing? You know, you're about to be a star. But obviously, you know, as someone works in the music industry, you never trust anything. Like, you never trust anything until, you know, the check is in the account or the contract is signed. I mean, things fall apart all the time. So, yeah, that was, you know, fascinating to watch for us, knowing how the story ends and, well, knowing how his career took off, to be like, what are you doing? But obviously, and especially at that time in hip-hop, because again, now in music is completely different. People have the means to record their own music, release their own music, people blow up overnight. Again, this was an era in hip-hop where if you follow the culture, you literally know everyone who's making music. Like, that's how few success, and those people aren't even necessarily successful. You have to also sell a certain amount to really be making money. So yeah, just to enter into his mindset at that time of like, yeah, I mean, I got a little song on this soundtrack and I hear it in people's cars, but this means nothing. It's hard for us to remember what hip hop was. When we spoke with KRS-One for Hip Hop Evolution, and he was talking about the time where he made The Bridge Is Over, which is a hip hop classic now, and he takes out like,
dun, 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 dun,
yeah, he, sorry, you know, one of the classic hip hop tracks. He's taken out every rapper in Queens. It's like, it's one of the most important songs in the history of hip hop. And he told us, I was sleeping on the train at that time. I mean, it's just, that's what hip hop was. It was this little world, you know. And yeah, he was just trying to be the king of it. But and Big, the beginning of Big's career is not that far removed from that. Hip hop was not a sure thing for anybody. So yeah, that was fascinating to watch, knowing, you know, from our point of view, how good he is, how much his career is about to take off, but like, he had no clue.
Can I add something to that? Yeah. Too, because I think at one point in the documentary he said, you know, we were growing up as children of immigrants, so we felt like outsiders. And I think that I've never, when he said that, I was like, oh, okay, that kind of, we all know what it's like to not fit in. And because they were, you know, first generation, even if they were, you know, the guy on the block, they still felt as if they didn't belong there. And when Big started dealing crack, he was 16. And another gem in the documentary that I didn't know, is he said that he loved to draw. And he gave up that dream when he started to deal crack because of the money. 16, how many decisions, like when you look back at 16, how many good decisions do we, any of us make, you know? And we all made bad decisions at that age because, again, we lacked the maturity. And I understand what you were saying, because I was like, your mom's a teacher, you know, and throughout the documentary, you had different voices. Some of his childhood friends say that his mom was always leaning out and looking down on the stoop and saying, Christopher, come in and eat. Christopher, do this. And she was always on him. So it's like you had somebody rooting for you. So why would you go down that road? But again, 16, you can't really see, where is my future beyond now? And if other people are saying, you know, this is how you can make money, And right now we're talking about racism. We're talking about systemic racism. Back then, I don't know if they were having those conversations. I don't think so. So as a 16-year-old black kid, what are your options? What are your options? And I think someone, there was three options. You end up dead, you end up in jail, or you end up dealing. And those were the options for him. Maybe he chose the right, the wrong one, obviously. And his mom in the documentary was very upset because she didn't know that that's what he was doing. I don't know. If he hadn't dealt crack, though, would he have ended up being making the music that he did? Because it ended up being a big part of his material. And, you know, as storytellers, we're always told to write what you know. And if he hadn't done that, maybe his music wouldn't have turned out the way it would have been. And, you know, like Shad said, in retrospect, we can look and say, well, you shouldn't have done that, or maybe you should have made a different choice. But he might not have ended up being big if he hadn't dealt crack. And this was part of his story.
Yeah. Well, sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to say that the more you dig into some of these great artists, the more you find these kind of fascinating tensions within their story, right? Like you were describing with Big, where, you know, he does have some good influences in his life, but he also has a lot of negative influences. And he is so talented, but he's also, you know, in the streets. And Tupac is probably the classic example of that. You know, all of these tensions within this guy. He's this art school kid, child of a panther, absolutely brilliant, but also has suffered all of these different traumas, including poverty. And so, yeah, to get more... I think we've always seen that with Pac. Like, that story's been told a lot with him. But we hadn't seen it before with Big, that, like, he's a child of immigrants in Brooklyn, like all of these tensions that live within him that are really like what end up creating this really great music and this really broad appeal that, again, like it's almost unmatched in hip hop. Like, the women love him, the dudes love him, the yeah. streets love him. He's kind of R&B, but he's the hardest MC. Like, all of that comes from, yeah, just all of these really deep tensions and contradictions.
I think there was also, I got a sense of Big felt responsible for a lot of different people. And I wonder if he had been one of those dudes who was just like, it's just about me, it's just about self, if he would have done some of the things that he did, not to excuse them, but he seemed to have a lot of he seemed to be a very loyal individual, where it was like, okay, I'm going to get us out of here. I'm going to make sure that everybody's taken care of. I'm going to make sure that my mom's taken care of. I'm going to make sure that my friends are taken care of. Little C's in the documentary at one point, he's like, you know, he keeps saying Junior Mafia, Junior Mafia. He's like, who's Junior Mafia? They didn't even know who Junior Mafia was. And then Big was like, you guys, you know, he was trying to get them to, so they can have their own thing, so they can build on their own. And one of the things that broke my heart was that, you know, the guy that got Big that helped Big start to deal crack, that showed him the ropes, is still alive. And some of the, most of his friends that he ran around with the exception of his best friend, Ollie, they were all still alive. And he tried to save so many people, but he couldn't save himself. And that's just, it's heartbreaking. And Shad, you're right. We knew so much about Tupac and the many complexities of who he was as a musician and as an individual. But with Biggie, I think this is the first time we see all these contradictions. And we're, again, this documentary is not just about how he died, but about how he lived and the many, many layers of who he was as a person.
You really hear those tensions in Ready to Die. Like, I was listening to it yesterday, and I just, you know, all the things he's talking about. I mean, there's obviously the things like that we're all familiar with, like dealing drugs and, you know, the more, I guess, sex oriented tracks, the more like, you know, Big Papa, that sort of thing. But then, you know, there's references to his mom having breast cancer. There's a whole track where he talks about wanting to kill himself and then does at the end.
Stress is building up. I can't believe suicide's on my fucking mind. I wanna leave. I swear to God, I feel like death is fucking calling me. Nah, you wouldn't understand.
Talk to me, please, man.
You see, it's kind of like the crack.
That darkness, you know, I knew it existed before, but I hadn't, I guess I hadn't heard it. I heard it differently when I watched this doc. I wonder what you guys made of it.
Yeah, I heard it. How did I hear it? I guess I heard it a lot in the context of like all of these challenges he was facing, right? Like his mom's cancer, as you said, his reluctance to believe that this was going to work out, this music thing is going to work out, like just in that way that I think we all relate to, but especially the younger part of us relates to, like, I don't want to get hurt, you know, I don't want to believe in something and have it not work out, you know. I really felt that acutely with him, and that's all heavy, you know. And then Nam, as you were just saying, plus all these people he's trying to help. I don't think we talk enough about the fact that he wrote a whole album for Junior Mafia. Like, not a lot of those people could write. He basically wrote that whole thing, you know, just so they could get on and just so they could have something, because he saw something in them. So if you think about all of that on someone who's, what, 20? That's heavy. That's really, really heavy. So yeah, I feel like I got a lot of insight into where that heaviness comes from. You know, wasn't as much as he naturally kind of flowed into this persona when he was on the mic, like that was not persona. Like, that was really what he was going through. That was really the weight of it on a young person, you know, coming out.
I think Pac at one point in the documentary says that Ready to Die is an uncomfortable album, and it is, because throughout the album he's talking about dying, and he does explain in the documentary that he didn't want to be dead, but, and I think the quote was that if I was dead, then I wouldn't have to worry about anything, because he had a lot of worries and he felt like the world was on his shoulders. I think the thing that I appreciated the most about that album, and I think listening to it now, is that I didn't understand how much he helped other men. He was so vulnerable with himself, and hip hop, rap music is a genre of music where, you know, yes, we have different, it frustrates me. People always talk about the thug music or the hardcore stuff, but hip hop has always been about elevating the community, about taking care of the community, education. And obviously the hardcore stuff has its place as well, because life is messy, life is hard. And in Ready to Die, he talks about that messiness, but he talks about it in the way where I think at that time, even now, a lot of dudes have a hard time, even a lot of women, I don't want to make generalizations here to take away from the point that I'm trying to make, is that he was very vulnerable and he was able to give people, listeners, that permission to say, I've been through this. It's hard to, I understand what it's like to go to that dark place, and to think about dying and to have the weight of the world on your shoulders and not to have an out. And the out for him was making the music. And when I listen back now as a grown up, as an adult, because I was listening to this in my late teens, early 20s, and I didn't know myself as an individual. Now I know myself as an individual. And I don't even know, when I think about him, like, how many men did he help by writing that music and expressing those thoughts and just giving them that partnership that, you know, I see you, I know it's hard, I've gone through this, and this is what it feels like. So, you know, yeah, some people might listen to it and they might think, oh, that's crass or that's, you know, but, you know, life is messy and it's not always pretty. And for a lot of people, life is really difficult. And
yeah, I think that's a very good point. Yeah, I mean, hip-hop is, it's the reason why Big and Pac, like, have resonated globally, you know, with a lot of young men, right? Like, just that permission to look at those feelings.
Yeah, I sort of wondered about just how 2021 we look at that music now, just some of the, I guess, crassness, as you put it, Nam, like, you know, because I can hear a song like Dead Wrong, which is not on Ready to Die, but it's, I love it. I think it's, you know, it's just really hard, and it's also got a lot of things said in it that are, you know, we can't air on this podcast, but it's, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, like, you know, there's always talk about cancel culture and then, you know, wokeness and everything like that. But it's one of those songs that I think people would kind of like, maybe, I don't know, some, there's some aspects of it people might cringe at. I don't know. I don't know if you feel that way when you hear it, but that's something I was thinking about when I was listening to his music this weekend.
It's part of the magic of Big, you know, it's just like, again, that broad appeal that he got away with it all. Mm-hmm. You just like the guy, you know, and people always point to his funeral and the procession through Brooklyn and to show like how loved he was. And it's true. And like, yeah, I mean, I think of certain lyrics just off the top of my head, I'm just like, wow, I can't believe he, you know, got away with that. But, you know, there's a thing of likability when you talk about entertainment, you know, and some people have it and some people don't. And he just had it in spades. And we got a glimpse with this as to why, you know, again, he was at the intersection of so many things. One thing I did want to say, this is like totally pivoting, but my favorite thing about the doc is the Brooklyn, the mapping of that area.
Yeah.
That was my favorite thing. Because Big made this place like mythical, like you were saying at the outset, Bedford Stuyvesant, like Brooklyn, like a lot of rappers before were from Brooklyn, but Big really put Brooklyn on the map and was always talking about Fulton and was always talking about these specific areas. And to see that mapped out, it's like that real detailed picture of what it was like. There's a book, Can't Stop, Won't Stop, by Jeff Chang. That's like one of the best texts about the early days of hip hop. And my favorite thing about that book was very similarly, like, it broke down the South Bronx, like by block, like New York City blocks, real blocks. Like, you know what a block means. It's not far. And so you talk about this guy, he just lived over there. Like, it's literally a 2-minute walk. That DJ lived over there and this artist lived over here. You know what that means. That's a 1.5-minute walk. Like, it's amazing. So again, you get a sense of like literally almost this fertile ground for, you know, culture and how much proximity plays into it and cities, you know.
And also kind of like, you know, there's certain blocks you can't go on. Like, I think Puffy said it, you know, he's from Harlem, but he couldn't just hop on a train to Brooklyn, you know, without, I guess, being invited. I thought that was really fascinating.
Yeah, and that's everyone we talked to from Hip Hop Evolution too would say that about that era in Brooklyn. Like, Brooklyn was where you got robbed. Like, it was like robbing specifically. Like, you get robbed in Brooklyn. They rob you. That's what people do in Brooklyn. And Puff is like, he's just strong.
He's like, I know my place.
He's a strong dude, but he's like, no, I know my place. Like, no.
Was there anything you felt the doc was missing?
I think it could have used a bit more tension in the sense that I think when documentaries, we all are messy people, right? We all have gone. I know when I was in my 20s, I was a bit of a jerk. And I work not to be a jerk. And I thought that it kind of didn't show, everybody who was talking about him was talking about him with reverence, with love. There wasn't anybody that said, well, he hurt me, or his mom, he definitely hurt his mother because he was kind of living a double life. But I just thought that they could have used that. He did this to me, but then, you know, I kind of made peace with it, or he made peace with me. It was just very clean. What I did like was the videos from his friend D-Rock. I don't think the documentary could have been made without that footage from the time that he was, you know, a young man wearing the suit to school and him rhyming to the battle that everybody started knowing about him when he was Biggie Smalls. I thought that was funny. When I was like, okay, so why did he stop being Biggie Smalls? Because I'm a journalist. I wanted to find out. Do you all know why he stopped?
Well, I think it was there was another guy named that, right?
Okay, so let me tell you. Yeah, so there was another guy who was a rapper. Wikipedia says he's Latino, but some people say that he was a white rapper from the West Coast. But here where it gets interesting, I mean, it could just be a coincidence. So this guy, Biggie Smalls, actually worked with one of his producers, went on to produce for Tupac. So he was connected to Tupac, like, you know. But I thought that was interesting because I was like, why did he change? Because Biggie Smalls is the illest. Your style is played out like Arnold and what you're talking about, Willis. I think that's one of the rhymes where people are like, okay, Biggie. And then he becomes Notorious B.I.G. So that cleared it up for me in the documentary. And I thought that was,
interesting.
There are little nuggets in the film like that.
I didn't know any of that.
Appreciated, yeah.
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 Well, I think one thing that's kind of missing, and it's, I think for good reason, because I think it's been told over and over again, is the East Coast, West Coast feud that eventually claimed both him and Tupac's life. And I think the only thing I was kind of surprised by, and I think maybe Hip Hop Evolution might have touched on this as well, Shad, is just that, you know, he went over there thinking that the beef was over, that he didn't really even think there was a beef. There was sort of a naivete on his part, which I thought was just really sad, because I think, you know, maybe if he had waited longer.
Yeah. I know. It's all this stuff that in retrospect, we're like, why, you know, but obviously you understand if you're at that time and he's feeling like, you know, I have nothing to hide. I didn't do anything wrong. Why can't I go to LA? I know there's people that love me there. I love Los Angeles and I love, you know, LA music. Like, why can't I go, right? So it's all this stuff that in retrospect, you know, we hate watching that part of the movie every time, but I get it, you know? The only thing I would have loved to see is a bit more about the making of Life After Death. And I know there's other docs that have like covered that, but it's not a perfect album, but what he demonstrates on that album to me really puts him in the pantheon forever. Like, he gets on the song with Bone Thugs and does their style, you know, and then he gets on Mo Money Mo Problems and, you know, just drops a verse that basically everyone knows to this day and is a smash. I mean, it's just, he's all over the place doing every style and just crushing it. Like, he's just beast mode, just doing everything on that album, you know? And so I would have loved to hear more about what that would have felt like to be around that. Like, just to be around this guy who's really come into his own and just watching him day after day making these songs that, you got to be, like, as an engineer or whoever might be in that room, as soon as he's cutting it, you just know, like, this is it. This song is a classic. We're just making classics every day. Like, I would have just loved a little bit more of that. Just as a music fan, that's where my interest is always, like, how did that song get made and what was it like? But every doc serves its purpose, right? You can't do everything. And this one, I think, was really about showing us who he was and what he was, you know, what he went through as a young man.
Yeah. Well, we kind of have to wrap up our conversation, but before we go, I have to ask both of you to name me your favorite Notorious B.I.G. track.
Can I pick two? Please don't judge me.
No
judgment here.
I'm going to pick Dreams and Warning.
Oh, good pick.
Don't judge me.
No, I don't judge.
I know. It's a contradiction. It's problematic, but, you know.
The first two to come to mind is unbelievable, and Sky's the Limit.
Nice. I want to. Yeah, I'm going to say Get Money.
Get Money is so incredible.
Get Money and Give Me the Loot. Give Me the Loot is just, like, I didn't even know that the other verse being done was by him. I thought it was a different rapper. It's just because he sped up his voice, right? Yeah,
I think that's why I like Warning, too, because it's, you know, he's having a conversation with himself.
He was just such an incredible storyteller. It just, it's, you know, I don't think there's been anyone like him. And, you know, as someone who I grew up listening to hip hop, I kind of fell off of it a little bit more recently, but I'm starting to come back to it. Yeah, like Ready to Die, you can put that up with any other album from this century or last century. You know, Sgt. Pepper, I don't care. Thriller, I don't care. Ready to Die goes up there. It's incredible. Well, Shad, I can't thank you enough for joining us. I wonder if there's anything you can tell us about what you're working on. I know Hip Hop Evolution's on Netflix and stuff, but...
Hip Hop Evolution obviously is on Netflix for, I don't know, forever, I guess. and yeah, I can't, you know, really say anything too much more beyond that. New music coming soon. But this is just like a pleasure, you know. I watched, obviously, as soon as that doc came out, I watched it, like, and just to get to chat with you guys about it, it was a pleasure.
Awesome. Thanks so much, man.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Shad.
Yeah.
And that's the podcast. You can watch Biggie, I Got a Story to Tell on Netflix.
And while you're here, why not give us a rating on Apple Podcasts and tell a friend, another friend, and another friend about us. And if you know Biggie, you know where that lyric was from. it helps us get new listeners to find the show.
You can follow me on Twitter at ColinEllis81.
And you can follow me at Namshine, all one word.
Thanks to producer and editor Matthew O'Mara, senior producer Katie O'Connor, production support coordinators Nikki Ashworth and Jonathan Hallowell, and executive producer Laurie Few.
Thanks for tuning in. We'll catch you at the next screening.